authors with respect to the issue of Ashura could be categorized into four categories. Some authors look at the history of Ashura from the viewpoint of history. It's a kind of mere history or analytical history.
That's right.
Another angle that authors have looked at the history of Ashura is a metaphysical angle that okay. from this aspect they're looking at the history of Ashura and this yes. uprising. And another category is the emotional
one. That's
category
right.
from this point of view. They
mostly
are
concerned with the rituals and sha'ayir or
definitely.
Something like that, okay?
And the fourth one is the mystical.
Or the Irfani one, that's
yes.
right.
So if okay. we wanted to say which one of these categories the work of Mr. Ayati will be fall in is the historical one.
That's right.
And specifically with respect to his work, investigation into the history of Ashura, we might say that the dominant context of his work is historical.
Historical one, that's right. So he's considering all the events which took place about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam according to the historical fact and historical context. I mean, the first things that comes to the minds of the historians are the realities which took place on that time, is it?
Yes, and the okay. main thing that he's doing with respect to this very important issue is to take all reports and oh. historical reports from the first-hand resources.
Okay, the first authentic ones, that's right.
Yes, okay. this is very important thing. And when he tries to deal with this okay. aspect of Ashura, one of the challenging point he is facing at his time is the distortion being entered in the history of Ashura.
Ashura, that's
so
right.
through handling history of Ashura from this aspect, he's trying to say that we have a lot of exaggeration and superstition
yes.
things
yes.
being mixed
yes.
with the true story of the Ashura.
That's right.
So he has no way except resorting to first-hand resources
that's right.
in order to prove his idea
okay.
right.
That's right.
There are a lot of distortions that we have to put it aside in order to get the pure
okay.
story of Ashura.
That's right. So this is the main research methodology of the late Ayati regarding the day of Ashura and the history of Karbala. But Sheikh Ziya, what is the place of now, I mean, for example, Ahadith or the Quranic verses in the historical look? I mean, are the historical look only concerned with the socio-political and cultural facts which took place on that time? Because most of the time, the historians, when they want to picture a context of an event, they get to these details. Where is the color of divinity in the historical method now?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Something that we must take into serious consideration here is that ahadith and ayat mainly are not the source of history.
Okay.
But sometimes they are giving us some hints. For example, the birth of Prophet Jesus.
Yes.
Some details about the event of Prophet Noah and his ark.
That's right.
Or some other issues that historians are looking for and they don't have some, you know, original resources.
That's right.
Here, Quran as a divine book is coming and giving some evidences to us,
that's right.
some hints to us. But Quran is not a history book.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not giving us the all details about the event. No, for example, about the birth of Prophet Jesus, it gives some part of the story and then we don't find the rest of the story
that's
in the
right.
book.
Okay.
So about riwayat, somehow the context is a bit different.
That's right.
We have more, you know, details in riwayat sometimes because riwayat are elaborating the verses of the Holy Quran sometimes, and this elaboration gives more details regarding the historical events. But again, riwayat also always are not the sources in history. It's maybe we can say that it's an evidence beside
oh,
other evidences.
That's right.
For example, sometimes we are looking for archaeological
yes.
evidences.
Yes.
Beside that,
mm-hmm.
we may go to also books
that's
of
right.
ahadith and also the Holy Book Quran.
Mm-hmm.
So, but these books are not history books.
Yes.
This is an important point. But
okay.
Regarding the approach of Dr. Ayati in his book,
mm-hmm.
yes, he's trying to put some lines between the authentic stories in the history and the non-authentic or fake stories in the history.
Yes.
Yes.
Also, he is giving some evidences regarding the time and the era of Muawiyah, that right. why the Islamic society is going to the direction that after 50 years of the demise of the Holy Prophet, mm-hmm. they are deciding to kill the grandson of His Holiness, I mean Holy Prophet, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
And do you believe that this method makes the story of Karbala more believable?
For sure.
For the rational people.
For sure. And Dr. Ayati is trying to highlight these distortions in the Islamic society. So late Dr. Ayati, first of all, he is trying to differ between the truths and falses.
Yes.
And secondly, he is trying to give evidences that why this movement was necessary for the
Muslim Ummah at that time.
Yes, Muslim Ummah.
And as Imam Hussein alayhi salam in his last will and testament to Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya wrote that this is for the correction or reformation of the Ummah of my grandfather and my forefather, that is Rasulullah, and also forbidding the evil and enjoining the good. That's all right. And through this historical, or it's better to say, realistic lenses on the eyes of a historian like Ayati, we can understand the context in which the Muslim Ummah, or Islamic community, is better to say, was deviated from the right path. Right after the demise of Prophet Muhammad, just 50 years after that, they are ready to kill and slaughter Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, his faithful companions, the peoples whose fathers were working and practicing Islam and embracing Islam for Prophet Muhammad, and went here and there in order to fight for Prophet Muhammad. But now what happened, that in 50 years the true path of Islam is deviated.
This is the exact point that Mr. Ayati at the continuation of the book refers to.
Okay.
That okay, because the situation was too dark, just giving speeches, that just speaking with people or just giving some advices to them was not enough for the Islamic society to get back to the right direction of Islamic beliefs.
That's right.
So that's why Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam decides to go to the battlefield of Karbala.
Karbala, that's all right. Sheikh Mahdavi, any point missed?
In terms of the realistic approach of Dr. Ayati, we might at this point that you might be rebuking people of Kufa. Why they didn't join Imam Hussein? He is saying that you have to go and read and see the history in the context they were living in. They said, okay, by the moment they were inviting Imam, reading the letters, the invitation letters for Imam, they felt that we have heard Imam Hussein is ready to go against Yazid and he's the only son of Imam Ali who may handle this. Yes. So let's write invitation letter for him.
Yes.
But by the moment Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad entered Kufa and threatened them, terrified them, they said, okay, if we join Hussein, he's going to kill us. So they were really like ordinary people. Okay. You just try to put their shoes and then judge yourself.
That's all.
Don't only blame them.
Okay.
This is with respect to the realistic approach that he had, and also from the history, the historical thing that are mentioned, like visiting the Karbala in the same year. For the actually the doing the Ziyarat al-Arba'in for the same for the same year, because he has a realistic approach. He's saying that this is impossible. It can't be true.
That's right.
Why? Because of the distance from Syria to Kufa and the time they were taken as a captives in the palace of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, and then from there to move to Syria, it is impossible to come back and give a visit to Imam Hussein's shrine in the same year.
Yes.
So he is that brave that he is going to go against all historians who mention this, no matter who is saying such a point. He's saying this is impossible. So we are not going to give any authentic look at such a point. So he was really kind of realistic historian, trying to investigate history based on the facts, not based on emotions and things like this. So this is concerning the realistic approach that he had.
But I think still this type of
methodology regarding the history of Islam and the Shia Islam has influenced the late Shahid Mutahhari and the following generations. Still, we have so many scholars and the ulama today who are looking at the history in this way. And I think this type of look at the history of Islam and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam opens a kind of dialogue with the other denominations and other religious minorities too. Because when you now look at the religious scholars from the other religions like Christianity and Judaism, you can see that they look at Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is a very historical one. And in that historical context, they can find how Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was brave to do such an action against the notorious Yazid and how his measurements were successful during the history. And this makes Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, I think, more believable for the people who are coming generation after generation and is accepted by other religions, other denominations, rather than Islam and the Shia Islams too. May Allah bless the soul of Dr. Muhammad Ibrahim Ayati. His works are still recalled and remembered, and we can say still many scholars and students and the house students and university students benefit from the outstanding resources that he compiled during his life. May Allah bless his soul. Unfortunately, we missed him very soon. In a car accident, 1343, in the fall of 1343, so many years before the Islamic Revolution of Iran took place, but he's still remembered in the minds of the people and the scholars all across Iran and the world of Islam. Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahtavi.
You're almost welcome.
And Sheikh Ziaynia, for your nice elaboration regarding the research methodology of the late Dr. Muhammad Ibrahim Ayati, regarding the history of Islam and the history of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and Karbala. And thank you very much, dear audience, for listening to us. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. You can download for free our previous episodes on this program. Also visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Assalamu alaikum, ya Abu Abdullah. I don't fear if from your cradle you depart.
In the limelight. Huge spending on the military has undermined U.S. economic growth. Increased spending on defense meant less funding allocated to education and other socio-economic programs. This misallocation of resources was a major reason the U.S. economy was slowing down, made worse by COVID-19 pandemic and the trade war between United States and China. We have prepared for you an article written by Ken Mook. Ken Mook taught economic theory, public policy, and globalization at university level for 33 years. The article is titled, Why Majority of Americans Support Costly Foreign Policies. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Democrats and Republicans may be at each other's throats when it comes to domestic policy, spending, and the size of U.S. government. But they are on the same page on foreign policies, protecting American supremacy or stifling any country that is in a position to challenge U.S. interests. In doing so, the U.S. government has spent lavishly and demanded that its allies do the same to stifle the purported China-Russia threat. Former President Donald Trump renamed the Asia-Pacific region Indo-Pacific, increasing Freedom of Navigation Operations, or FONOPs, and reviving the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, or Quad. Donald Trump also demanded that NATO allies increase defense spending to 2% of their gross domestic product, or GDP. Current President Joe Biden not only carried on with Donald Trump's foreign policies on China and Russia, but has in fact intensified them. Joe Biden wanted to formalize and expand the Quad into a military alliance that would include South Korea, Vietnam, and others. However, huge spending on the military has undermined U.S. economic growth. Increased spending on defense meant less funding allocated to education and other socio-economic programs. This misallocation of resources was a major reason the U.S. economy was slowing down, made worse by the COVID-19 pandemic and U.S.-China trade wars. Escalating tensions in the Asia-Pacific region and politicizing the origins of COVID-19 have worsened the security environment, climate warming, and the pandemic. Holding frequent Freedom of Navigation Operations, or FONOPs, in the Asia-Pacific region has triggered an arms race of some sort between the United States and China. Each country is spending more and more on weapons development and weapons production. The Freedom of Navigation Operations and China's tit-for-tat response have a real possibility of turning the situation into a hot war. Costly and dangerous as U.S. foreign policies are, still the majority of the American public support them. For example, most American farmers, the most harmed by the trade wars, supported Donald Trump and his China policies because they wrongly believe China is a threat to U.S. national interests. This raises the question, why do most Americans support these self-inflicting harmful policies? One answer is that the so-called yellow peril narrative is not far below the skin for many Americans, believing China is a national economic and national security threat. Another is the role of groups that benefit from confrontational policies. U.S. foreign policies have turned out to be hugely profitable not only for the military-industrial complex, but also for the financial institutions, for the think tanks and the media. For example, weapons producers require large loans from banks to fulfill contractual obligations. Publishing subjective news about adversaries increased readership. Think tanks and pundits received large rewards to spin the anti-Chinese rhetoric, so there is real incentive for these groups to cheer and to lobby the government to implement confrontational policies. A case in point is how the military-industrial complex has succeeded in inventing an enemy, shaping public policies by manipulating public opinion against it, making generous election campaign donations to both major political parties, and dispersing weapons production across the country. In the aftermath of the Second World War, the United States turned against the Soviet Union, accusing it of expanding wrong ideology to Europe and to the world. The United States first instituted the Marshall Plan, showering countries with money that were willing to toe the line on American values and ideals. The recipients were also required to spend the funds on U.S. goods and services. The United States then established the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, a military alliance composed of democratic Western nations to counter Soviet Union. The formation of NATO proved profitable for the military-industrial complex because it could not only sell arms to the United States, but to its allies as well. However, spending more on defense against a perceived enemy undermined economic growth at home because less was allocated to education and to other socio-economic programs. At the same time, escalated tensions with the former Soviet Union heightened the security risk in Europe and at home. The Soviet Union responded with the establishment of the Warsaw Pact, a military club consisting of itself and Eastern European countries. The conflicts between US and Western Europe and the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe led to the Cold War, under which both sides spent huge amounts of money on defense. The collapse of the former Soviet Union thus brought joy to Americans because it was supposed to generate a peace dividend. They thought the money that was being spent on weapons would be reallocated to education, to healthcare, and employment creation programs. However, the opposite was true. Instead of bringing economic growth, the economy slowed down. This was because the states that depended on defense spending, such as California, turned into economic basket cases. Furthermore, declining military spending hurt the bottom line of the military-industrial complex, forcing them to lay off workers. To reverse the economic and financial misfortunes, an enemy had to be created. China became the ideal candidate because it was Asian, and most important of all, in a position to challenge America's hegemony in almost, if not all, fields. China's successful economy with Chinese characteristics, development architecture allowed the country to become a near peer power to the United States. The Asian power was able to reject the US-imposed world order and compete with the United States in most, if not all, fields, including in technology and military. China's rise was unacceptable to both the US Democrats and US Republicans, in that foreign policies were configured to maintain global dominance and protect national security. What's more, politicians on both sides of the political divide were obligated to defend the military-industrial complex's interests. Politicians, particularly those sitting on the Congressional Armed Services Committees and representing weapons-producing states, received generous campaign donations from the military-industrial complex. This was meant to influence the lawmakers to make favorable decisions. It worked, as the overly bloated U.S. defense budget of more than $750 billion attests. The politicians gained because they were seen as bringing home the bacon or looking after the nation's interests. Increasing weapons purchases translated into greater economic and employment opportunities. Anti-China politicians were also seen as the so-called patriots, defending America from its enemies, though no country has ever threatened the United States. Demonizing China was largely responsible for Donald Trump winning the White House race in 2016. Anti-China and anti-Russia sentiments were manipulated by politicians with the help of the media and pundits. For instance, the Washington Post published the allegation that the coronavirus had caused the COVID-19 pandemic was actually leaked from Wuhan Institute of Virology, without bothering to verify the claim. The same was true on other issues. The media and pundits kept on accusing the Chinese government of committing genocide and forced labor in Xinjiang without any credible evidence. Indeed, it could be argued that the charges did not make much sense and were contrary to what was happening on the ground. So there is no surprise that U.S. politicians, senior officials, and even presidents acted as arms salesmen, influencing allies and friends to buy American-made weapons against China and other like-minded governments. As indicated earlier, weapons manufacturing is big business, at least for the few that benefited directly from it. Whether U.S. confrontational foreign policies serve the national interest would depend on one's perspective. But there is evidence to suggest that these policies have heightened national security risks, undermined economic growth, widened the gap between the rich and the poor, and increased poverty. The trade wars with China have worsened U.S. economic woes, increasing production costs and consumer prices. Worse, the U.S. trade deficit with China has actually increased and manufacturing activities decreased, the very reasons for the trade wars. Focusing on war and aggression instead of education and healthcare has diluted the quality and productiveness of the American labor force. In the era of globalization, this is a no-no because poor quality and unhealthy workers will not be able to compete in the world market.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, why is debt bad? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. A little debt won't hurt, will it? That's how it starts. You make a small purchase on your credit card, and then before you know it, you are thousands of dollars, or euros, or pounds in debt. But what exactly is wrong with having a little or a lot of debt? That's another question that comes to our mind. To start with, here are some of the problems debt can cause in your life. And we're going to go through a list of problems in successive programs. Because one of the issues that we see many believers, unfortunately, are struggling with and dealing with in their everyday lives is the problem and issue of debt. They accumulate so much debt that they can't get out of that whirlpool. The first issue that we have brought for you that debt causes in your life is that debt encourages you to spend more than you can afford. There's something about the debt that tempts you to keep spending, even when you can't afford the payments. Part of the allure of debt is the fact that you can get the emotional high from getting new things now, without having to deal with the immediate pain of parting with money. It can feel like you are getting something for nothing. But eventually, that spending will catch up with you, and it won't feel so good then. Somehow, people do conclude that, you know, anything that they're getting without paying anything immediately, it is free. No, it's not. You are the one who has to make the payment. So one of the first issues is this whole spending more than you can afford. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about why debt is bad. Well, the first one was debt encourages you to spend more than you can afford. The second one is debt costs money. Debt feels free when you are swiping your credit card or signing loan documents. But this is an illusion. Remember, brothers and sisters, all the believers out there, this is a big illusion, especially in the Western part of the world. Those who live in the West, because the system is so surrounded with the debt-based, loan-based, and interest-based systems, you get easily pulled into it. In general, you pay a price for the debt you create. That price comes in the form of interest. The higher the interest rate, the more you will end up paying for your debt. Also, the longer it takes you to pay off and the higher your debt load, the more interest you will pay. Especially the youth out there who are listening to this, don't make the mistakes that your elders may have made. You don't have to tread the same path. Don't run after your wishes. Debt is something, generally speaking, especially in the West, it is a result of one running after their whims and wishes. The only exception is an interest-free loan or 0% APR credit card promotion. But even that has a limit and can be lost if you default your payments. Just one sentence on this. Have you ever thought why in the world these big banks and big financial institutions would come up with 0% APR? Do they love you? Do they love human beings? If they did, they would take care of poverty in the world. Guess what the strategy is? The strategy is to get you addicted to it and used to of it. Once you take a loan at 0% APR, they have opened up this door for you to become used to of taking loan to fulfill your whims and wishes. Be careful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Taliban have announced an all-male caretaker government, including an interior minister wanted by the FBI, on a day when at least two people were killed by violent policing of street protests against the new authorities in Afghanistan. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Emma Graham Harrison and Akhtar Muhammad Makui. The piece is titled, Taliban Name All-Male Afghan Cabinet, Including Minister Wanted by FBI. Stay with us for more. Taliban have announced an all-male caretaker government, including an interior minister wanted by the FBI, on a day when at least two people were killed by violent policing of street protests against the new authorities in Afghanistan. The leadership, unveiled on Tuesday, 7th of September, is drawn entirely from Taliban ranks. Despite promises of an inclusive cabinet, and many of its senior figures are on United Nations sanctions lists, which is likely to complicate the group's search for international recognition. Late on Tuesday, 7th of September, a U.S. State Department spokesman said, "We note the announced list of names consists exclusively of individuals who are members of the Taliban or their close associates and no women. We also are concerned by the affiliations and track records of some of the individuals. We understand that the Taliban has presented this as a caretaker cabinet. However, we will judge the Taliban by its actions and not by its words." The U.S. State Department renewed its call on the Taliban to offer safe passage to U.S. citizens as well as to Afghan citizens looking to leave the country. Afghanistan will once more be officially known as an Islamic Emirate, as it was under Taliban rule in the 1990s. The Prime Minister will be Mullah Muhammad Hassan Akhund, one of the founding members of the group, who was close to its original leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar. He has had far less international exposure than other senior Taliban leaders, but as head of the group's powerful leadership council, he is one of its most influential members. Mullah Muhammad Omar's son, Mullah Yaqub, will be defense minister in the new caretaker government, and the acting interior minister is Siraj ad-Din Haqqani, who is on the FBI wanted list. In his first statement since the Taliban seized power last month, Mullah Muhammad Hassan Akhund said Afghanistan's new rulers were committed to all international laws, treaties and commitments not in conflict with Islamic law. "In the future, all matters of governance and life in Afghanistan will be regulated by laws of Holy Sharia," he said. The Taliban face a major economic crisis, domestic pressure from political opponents, and an uprising in Panjshir Valley that has not been entirely stamped out despite their capture of the provincial capital in Panjshir. International pressures were highlighted by protests in Kabul that drew hundreds of people and which, although initially peaceful, ended in the Taliban firing guns into the air, beating protesters and journalists, seizing equipment, and detaining some people. A smaller protest in the western city of Herat ended with two dead and at least four injured, according to the Afghan newspaper Ettala-Taruz. The Guardian saw video of Taliban dispersing protesters with gunfire. With domestic reserves frozen and the country long dependent on international aid, there is also a desperate search for international legitimacy that may allow funds to keep flowing into Afghanistan. The government lineup is unlikely to offer progress on any of those fronts. Instead, it appears primarily designed to prevent internal fractures within the Taliban movement, after weeks of heated internal discussions about power sharing, said Harun Rahimi, a law professor at the American University of Afghanistan. "It won't help with domestic legitimacy. It won't help with international recognition. It will not help ease the resistance, and it will not help government run more smoothly," he said, pointing out that few ministers had expertise in their portfolios. "So I have to conclude that the only reason they chose this kind of makeup was to make sure there will be no internal fractures." The new cabinet is also heavily dominated by the Pashtun ethnic group that formed the Taliban's original power base, but which makes up only about 40% of Afghanistan's population. Just three appointees in the new caretaker government appear to be from other ethnic groups. It was unveiled by the government spokesman, Zabihullah Mujahid. Asked about the lack of inclusivity, Mujahid could offer only vague promises that the minor portfolios outstanding may be awarded in a way that broadens the government. Some ministers and deputies and many top positions are remaining. We will try to include people from across the country into it. It's not a permanent cabinet, and we will try to make it more inclusive, Zabihullah Mujahid said. Another sign that Taliban promises of change, including respect for media freedom, were being tested by the reality of governing. Zabihullah Mujahid said people should not be protesting at this time because the country had recently emerged from a crisis. He also suggested that some protesters were incited from abroad, a possible reaction to the fact that many of those on the streets were attacking the Taliban as an instrument of the Pakistani government. For two decades, Pakistan provided the Taliban with safe haven, and the head of its influential Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, or ISI, spent 3 days in Kabul this week as negotiations about the new government were hammered out. But the Taliban and Islamabad deny any significant ties. There were no immediate response to the new government from the countries that have bankrolled Afghanistan's aid in the past, and now face the prospect of engaging with a leadership dominated by figures who are on United Nations sanctions lists. There is pressure for the international community to work with the Taliban to try to stave off disaster for the most vulnerable of the country's 38 million inhabitants. The United Nations has warned that access to food aid and other life-saving services is close to running out, as concerns mount that the country is facing a looming humanitarian catastrophe. The grim assessment from the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs came amid an appeal for an extra $200 million in emergency funding in Afghanistan after the Taliban's takeover sparked a host of new problems. The United Nations says 18 million Afghans are facing a humanitarian disaster, and a further 18 million people could quickly join them.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan in a matter of weeks and seized control of the capital, Kabul, without facing much resistance from the U.S.-trained Afghan security forces, as foreign troops and citizens were scrambling to leave the country before a deadline set by U.S. President Joe Biden. The security situation at the international Kabul airport deteriorated to the point where U.S. intelligence agencies warned about an extreme risk to people present at or in the vicinity of the airport. On August 26th, a bomb attack hit the crowds outside the airport, killing over 180 people, including 13 U.S. military personnel. The attack was claimed by an offshoot of the Daesh terror group called Daesh-K. The Taliban said the attack took place in an area that was supposed to be secured by the U.S. troops. The group also blamed the U.S. and the hurried evacuations for the incident, saying there wouldn't be any bomb attack if the situation were calmer. Daesh-K has fought both foreign forces and the Taliban in Afghanistan since its formation in 2015. The Taliban now say they don't need international help to uproot the terrorists.
The U.S. has been 20 years in Afghanistan, has accomplished nothing good. The Taliban doesn't want U.S. involved anymore, but the fact that a country doesn't want U.S. involvement doesn't mean U.S. will not be involved. Let's hope that this is ending, but that remains to be seen.
Army General Mark Milley, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, had earlier floated the possibility of coordinating strikes against Daesh with the Taliban. The United States has no longer any army troops on the ground in Afghanistan, nor any air bases near the country. Washington, however, has pledged to continue what it calls fighting terrorism in the Central Asian country. The only way for the U.S. to carry out strikes on Afghanistan is by deploying its aircraft carriers. The U.S. is reportedly considering keeping its aircraft carriers in the region, including in the Arabian Sea, to continue its operations there. But that requires new calls for funds and creates some technical obstacles, including intelligence collection over such long distances. It also means that President Biden's claim about wanting to end America's endless wars is somewhat misleading. In the meantime, some U.S. politicians are expecting troops back on Afghanistan's soil.
We will be going back into Afghanistan as we went back into Iraq and Syria. To the
Are you seriously think the United States will once again, in a foreseeable future,
yes,
put troops back into
Afghanistan? We'll have to, because the threat will be so large.
But while even some of Washington's NATO allies have expressed their dissatisfaction with the outcome of the 20-year-long war, how is going back to Afghanistan feasible for the United States?
Lindsey Graham, of course, is very anxious to have more wars. He's heavily financed in his campaigns by military contracts in the U.S. In the 2020 election cycle, they donated nearly $400,000 to his campaign. So he is, and this is not new in 2020, he has often said how much he supports rebuilding the military, as he calls it, in order to protect U.S. freedoms.
The fact that the Taliban came to power even before the foreign troops left Afghanistan's soil shows that the West's military intervention in the country can never succeed.
On April 7, 2018, an alleged chemical weapon attack in the city of Douma, Syria, killed at least 50 people. The suspected chemical attack involved two chlorine cylinders dropped from a Syrian Air Force helicopter. Following the incident, the Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations said that the symptoms of the casualties were consistent with exposure to a nerve agent. Almost a week later, the United States accused the Syrian government of using chemical weapons containing chlorine and the nerve agent sarin to bombard Douma. Syrian President Bashar Assad accused the US, UK, and France of staging the attack in Douma, saying the attack did not take place. He called the whole incident a lie and called on the Western governments to provide evidence for the accusations. Also, after a group of Russian specialists tested Douma's soil samples, Moscow confirmed that the results showed no presence of substances containing chlorine or any sort of nerve agents in Douma. Russia also confirmed that Douma's hospitals had not received any patients with symptoms of exposure to sarin or chlorine. On April 14th, hours before the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons fact-finding mission team arrived in Damascus, the US, UK, and France conducted missile strikes against the Syrian government. Former US President Donald Trump claimed Washington seeks to establish a deterrent against the production, spread, and use of chemical weapons. However, The Syrian Foreign Ministry denounced the attacks as barbaric aggression. Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple President Assad. Western governments, the US in particular, have used different ways from proxies and direct involvement to crippling economic sanctions to oust the Syrian government, yet they have failed. Now, the BBC has admitted that its documentary on an alleged 2018 chemical weapon attack in Syria contains serious inaccuracies. The BBC says it had no evidence to back up a claim that a former chemical weapons inspector, in exchange for money, had expressed doubts over the conclusion that the attack was carried out by Damascus. That could justify the reason why war on Syria has continued for this long.
Well, the war on Syria was always based on lies, on complete fabrications, repeated endlessly. They were, from the very beginning, an attempt to pull down, totally dismember Syria. They were part of the U.S. and Western allied war in the whole region, also against Iraq, the continuing threats on Iran, the destruction of Libya. So Syria was very much a part of this, and the fact that they've absolutely failed in this effort, now, like, you know, a can of worms, the truth begins to sort of ooze out, because they're not willing to continue the war. They see what the U.S. complete defeat in Afghanistan led to, so I think that's why the exposés now. But this was always a lie, and from the beginning, it was very thoroughly debunked.
UK's national broadcaster, the BBC, has admitted that its documentary on an alleged 2018 chemical weapon attack in the Syrian city of Douma contained serious inaccuracies. The program reported that a former inspector with the International Chemical Weapons Watchdog had expressed doubts over the organization's stance on the incident. The watchdog, in its probe into the incident, had blamed it on the Syrian government, a charge Damascus denied. The BBC program claimed the inspector was motivated to go public about his doubts in return for getting financial reward from the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks. Now, the British Broadcasting Corporation has accepted that it had no evidence to back up that claim. Also, WikiLeaks has said such a reward was never paid.
The excuse of chemical weapons was used in Syria again and again. In 2012, 2013, it was used for the sanctions on Syria. It was used for the U.S. beginning military actions. The latest expose in Douma in 2018 was at a time when every report said Syria was clearly winning the war, and that was why this massive new level of bombardment, happened. They just found a new story. All of the media used it. Hundreds and hundreds of news articles from every direction screamed about it. And now we find it's just a fabrication.
It's surprisingly rare for the BBC to rule against itself. The recent confession is hailed as a major victory for truth. Next Saturday marks the 20th anniversary of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center buildings in New York City. The attacks resulted in tragic death of nearly 3,000 people, while thousands more were injured. For 20 years, successive U.S. administrations have refused to release classified documents related to the investigations of the September 11 terrorist attacks. The documents reportedly could expose a potential link between Saudi Arabia and the hijackers, as 15 out of 19 alleged attackers were Saudi nationals. Also, publicly released documents, including by the 9/11 Commission, have detailed numerous Saudi entanglements, but failed to prove government complicity. The Saudi government has routinely denied any connections to the attacks. In recent months, pressure has mounted on the Biden administration as families of the 9/11 victims demand answers in regard to Saudi government's role in the terrorist attacks on the U.S. soil. Last month, nearly 1,800 Americans directly affected by the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center called on U.S. President Joe Biden to skip the 20th anniversary events unless he upholds his pledge to declassify evidence that could link Saudi Arabia to the attack. President Biden is currently facing sharp criticism over his administration's response to the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan and the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. troops from the country after 20 years of war. It seems in a bid to deflect the criticism and the pressure on his shoulders, Biden finally gave in and signed an executive order which directs the Justice Department and other federal agencies to begin a review of documents and release declassified information over the next 6 months. U.S. officials assert that Al-Qaeda terrorists carried out the 9/11 attacks. However, many experts and independent researchers have questioned the official account. They believe that rogue elements within the U.S. government orchestrated or at least encouraged the 9/11 attacks in order to accelerate the U.S. war machine and advance the Zionist agenda.
I think it is implausible to believe that 19 people, most of whom didn't speak English, most of whom had never been in the United States before, many of whom didn't have a high school education, could have carried out such a complicated task without some support from within the United States.
Bob Graham and others believe that the United States has deliberately shielded the Saudi Arabia by refusing to expose their links to the attacks in order to protect the Washington-Riyadh relationship. Indeed, Washington's alliance with Riyadh is a lucrative one. Saudi Arabia is the biggest arms importer in the world and alone accounted for 24% of total U.S. arms exports between 2016 and 2020. Weapons which have been used in Yemen war to kill thousands of innocent children and civilians and cause the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Furthermore, U.S. President Joe Biden has previously refused to penalize the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, despite the fact that he promised to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state for Khashoggi's killing and other abuses during his 2020 presidential campaign.
Well, I don't know. The Saudis will definitely react. Whether the United States will do anything, I don't know. I think that the implication here is that we would reduce arms sales or something like that. But, you know, there's such pressures on the economy to maintain the arms sales that I think that there will be some comments. There will be efforts by the Progressive Caucus in the Democratic Party to rein in the Saudis. But I think in the end, unless the real leadership in the State Department and the CIA decides that the Saudis are too much of a price to pay, that other than comments, nothing is going to happen.
Washington has been shielding Riyadh for the 9/11 attacks for two decades. What's for sure is that the lucrative alliance with the Saudis and the kingdom's green dollars have lured Washington to turn a blind eye to Riyadh's crimes.
Weeks after the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan, the world is still evaluating the results of the West's 20-year-long war in the country. The United States have faced criticism over its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and its achievements in the Central Asian country. The unexpectedly rapid fall of the Afghan capital, the scenes of chaos at the Kabul International Airport where hundreds of people desperate to leave the country had gathered, and the bomb attack claimed by the Daesh terror group that killed over 170 people, including 13 U.S. troops, have all raised questions about the U.S. military superiority. That's an issue British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace raised in an interview with The Spectator magazine.
It's obvious that Britain is not a superpower, but a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It is certainly not a global force, it's just a big power.
This wasn't the first time that the British Defense Secretary has criticized Washington, a close UK ally. Back in August, he said former US President Donald Trump's decision to clinch a deal with the Taliban was a mistake.
I would say if it's a superpower or not is pretty irrelevant. The United States is still the greatest danger facing the world and the greatest concentration of private power against our species that has ever existed.